From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It wasn't that long ago that doctors were extremely resistant to giving narcotics to patients to treat their pain, even in extreme cases. But the journalist Sam Quiñones says by the 1990s, attitudes started to change, and well-intentioned doctors started prescribing opiates, believing they weren't addictive. So by the 2000s, a pain revolution was complete in this country. Doctors were prescribing narcotics for wisdom teeth extraction and bad knees and headaches and carpal tunnel syndrome. And Quiñones says it's now an epidemic. So today in the program, he's joining us to explain how we got here. We'll talk about how opioids work, how they were developed and marketed, and how morphine became the poster molecule for the age of excess. Join us after the news.
Every morning, Radio West brings you an hour-long conversation with interesting people, talking about ideas, telling stories, and exploring the way the world works. Radio West is made possible by listeners throughout Utah who value in-depth local programming. Show your love for Radio West today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. All right, here's a statistic to get your attention. Every month, there are 24 people who die from prescription drug overdoses in Utah. It's a statistic that makes the state fourth in this country for drug poisoning deaths. Last year, the journalist Sam Quiñones wrote a powerful exploration of opioid addiction. The book he wrote is called Dreamland, and in it, he writes about a kind of pendulum that has swung back and forth when it comes to Americans and their attitudes about pain. It used to be that doctors feared opiates. They didn't want patients listless and addicted. But then in the 90s, Quiñones says the pendulum started to swing the other way. Now, there are a lot of forces at play here. Marketing and managed care and an earnest desire to help patients stop hurting. But Quiñones says what emerged was this revolution of pain management that held this. We are a country in pain, and the way to treat it is with pills. There's a summit going on tomorrow in Salt Lake City about opioid addiction, and it's giving us an opportunity to talk about how we got here. Sam Quiñones joined us earlier today. He's a journalist, former LA Times reporter. He's going to be speaking at the Utah Heroin and Opioid Summit. We'll give you some more details about that a little bit later. He joined us from the studios of Southern California Public Radio earlier today. And in his book, he identifies this shift that goes on beginning in the late 80s and 90s, where the heroin that had come from the Far East started coming from Mexico. It was this very potent, very cheap supply of heroin called black tar heroin. And Quiñones found this fascinating because he says it was contrary to everything he understood about drug trafficking.
I always thought that the way as a drug trafficker grabbed market share was by shooting the rivals, starting with Al Capone, you know, and then the Colombians and the Bloods and the Crips. You've seen this many a time. These guys did not use guns largely because they were in many towns like Salt Lake and Boise and Denver. They were competing with each other, people they knew. So they couldn't really kill each other. They knew where each other's mothers lived. It would cause problems back home. They didn't even use guns, really, largely because this was a system that channeled the desires of poor young men who were not cartel killers. They were farm workers and bakers and butchers, just looking for a leg up. Had someone come along with a system of finding work as a landscaper in Dallas in their town, they'd all been landscapers in Dallas.
Right.
And so this system kind of develops, and then because they can't kill each other, they become great marketers, because that's how you grab market share: branding, customer service, and also then expansion, moving to new places, and they become intensely expansionary around about the late 80s. Early 1990s, and they land in Salt Lake City in the mid 1990s, and it's a system that is born by the desire of these guys to move ahead, but not in the United States. Their desire is to move ahead back home.
Right.
So they live like church mice here, very frugally and very quietly, and then they go home, and that's where they spend their money. But yeah, it's a very much like a pizza delivery system where you call the operator. The operator sends a driver to wherever you are and delivers black tar heroin in the form of a tenth of a gram dose of heroin in a little balloon.
Yeah.
And this is a system that they took all across the country, 25 states I've counted them in.
And they stayed away from big cities, didn't want to go to New York and places
They stayed
like
away from the established heroin markets,
yeah.
which surprised me too. They were in a lot of mid-sized cities. They stayed away from New York, Baltimore, Philadelphia, D.C., which I always considered our classic heroin corridor, you know. Largely because they were not killers. They were not gunslingers. They were quiet guys who wanted to just make their money and leave. And in those cities, the heroin trade was dominated by gangs with guns.
Yeah.
And that's the last thing they wanted. So they looked for towns where there was no competition, where there was no gang, mafia control or anything like that. And they found many, many of them, smaller, I would say mid-sized cities like Salt Lake, mm-hmm. Columbus, Charlotte, Minneapolis, Reno, et cetera, those kinds of towns.
Which gets us to Dreamland, which is the name of this massive private pool and kind of community center. And this is in Portsmouth, Ohio. And in your book, you describe the place as ground zero of an almost viral explosion of opiate use and abuse. Talk about Portsmouth and Dreamland.
Right. Portsmouth was, in its heyday, a grand American town, a wonderful example of American manufacturing. It had a steel mill. It had many shoe factories, shoemaking factories. It had the largest shoelace manufacturer in America. It had a bustling Main Street, 50,000 people in the town. And the center of the town, almost like the soul of the town, was this beautiful, enormous football field-sized swimming pool, one of the largest swimming pools in America. It was the babysitter. It was where everyone saw each other. It's where everyone grew up under the watchful eyes of hundreds and hundreds of parents. The guy who owned it reinvested the money from the pool, and it kept on getting larger, more grounds, more picnic grounds, baseball field, basketball court, et cetera, et cetera. And it became a cycle of life took place at this pool, at Dreamland. It was the center of town. And in 1980, the steel mill leaves.
Yeah.
The shoe factories begin to leave. The town begins a long period of decline. Half the population leaves. And in 1993, they dig up and destroy Dreamland Pool. And in its place now is a very large parking lot to a strip mall with an O'Reilly's auto parts store. That left the town, my conception is that left the town almost without an immune system, a societal immune system. That community that had been so important was savaged, was stripped from the town and left it vulnerable, very much like the Indians when the Europeans came over and their vulnerability to smallpox. And so this was also, though, the time within a few years of that happening. This was a time with the pain revolution in America, where, again, as you said earlier, we believe that we're an epidemic of pain. We needed to treat it very aggressively. We needed to treat it very aggressively with both opiate painkillers, and the way pharmaceutical companies and pain specialists sold that to doctors was to say, we now know that these pills are non-addictive. The place where they really did that first, the very, very start of this pain revolution and the very aggressive marketing of those pain pills, was really the area where Portsmouth is kind of the center of it.
Yeah.
Columbus to the north, Cincinnati to the west, West Virginia, eastern Kentucky. In the center of that, right on the Ohio River, is this little town of Portsmouth, Ohio, that has just had its the very girdings of its community stripped away. It becomes a place where the pill mill is invented. That's a pain clinic. Doctors are opening pain clinics. Well, as part of this pain revolution, well, part of that is a certain number of doctors become intensely corrupted by the insistence of pain patients, the fact that they can charge cash for doctor visits, not insurance. One doctor in particular starts it. And he begins to hire other doctors. He was called the Ray Kroc of the pill mill, kind of.
Is this David Proctor?
His name is David Proctor, yeah. Right? He was a very popular doctor. This was a time, it's also important to keep in mind, this was a time when doctors were viewed as the key to life strategies in the face of economic decline. Yeah. Doctors could get you with the proper forms filled out, workers' comp, SSI insurance, SSDI, a variety of things like that. And so doctors were already viewed as the key to some solution to the catastrophe of economic decline for a lot of people. And David Proctor was a very popular guy because he could do that. He would do that. Yeah. And in time, he kind of invented this clinic that became the first pill mill in America. Everybody else kind of followed suit. A lot of doctors copied it. Soon, people in town, in Portsmouth itself, who had no medical background whatsoever, began opening them because Ohio state law allowed it. Felons, junkyard dealer, a bailiff, et cetera, all these different kinds of people. Eventually, there was a dozen pill mills in one town prescribing upwards of 9 million pills Wow. A year. And the whole town, really the whole town, certainly a generation or two of the town, gets intensely addicted to opiate painkillers.
Underneath all of this is kind of this larger theme that you explore in the book. It's an idea, and here's how you describe the idea in the book. It's the idea that permanent pleasure, numbness, and the avoidance of pain, that man's decay is always begun as soon as he has it all, free of friction, free of pain, free of deprivation that can temper his behavior. And this, you say that when you were in Mexico, because you were there for several years, you kind of missed the revolution going on in the United States. And when you come back, you say you start to see everything you say seemed obese and excessive, that America Right. had kind of been contaminated. It's kind of a big theme in the book. I wanted Yes. you to say something about that.
Yes, when I started the book, I really thought I was writing a drug book, a true crime book. Instead, I got into this topic and I realized that this was more about there was far deeper themes here Yeah. that were about Americans and who we'd become, what kind of country we had become. Certainly, especially I would say after the Cold War, most definitely since the Reagan Revolution, the end of the Cold War, we become kind of complacent, feeling entitled, wanting it all, comfort above all things, and so. So yeah, you see obesity in all things, obesity in the houses, mm-hmm. obesity in the cars, the SUVs, the Hummers back then, you remember, were just massive. Down to, in fact, I think I mentioned even the Halloween candy. The Halloween candy now is quadruple the size of what it was when I was a kid. You know, meanwhile, everyone retreats indoors too. Nobody really spends any time outside. Parents are terrified now of letting their kids go outside, fearing some kind of mishap or pain or child molestation or who knows what all. You know, and so you get this kind of isolating thing. At the same time, we're becoming very entitled and interested only in our own comfort, or virtually mostly in our own comfort. We also become very kind of shut-ins and isolated from each other. We tend to believe, in those years particularly, I think growing since the 1950s, but especially true in the 1990s and 2000s, that consumption, that stuff, was the road to happiness. And the lack of pain. We were almost entitled. We felt entitled. Part of the pain revolution was that had nothing to do with doctors. It had to do with us, yeah. American health consumers, saying we deserve a life. We are entitled to a life without pain. First time kind of anybody ever thought that since, I suppose, the kings of the Renaissance or something. You know, it's a feeling like we needed. We were a special at a part. We'd won the Cold War. We'd beaten capitalism at one. And now was our time to kind of kick back. And at the same time, we all kind of retreated indoors. Yeah. Nobody wanted a kind of a communal aspect. Government was the problem. Private enterprise was applauded and exalted. The government was laughed at. And in a democracy, it's as if to say, well, we don't really need community. We can go it alone. Heroin comes along, and in my opinion, is kind of the poster drug of that era, of that idea. It's the final expression of like 35 years of values that we've been fostering. Mm. Very isolating suburbia. It happens in poor communities, happens in wealthy ones too. Lack of jobs is not the reason. It's more like an isolation that is a malaise across the country.
One of the things you wanted to kind of examine in the book is understand the molecule behind the story. And you write this, you say that like no other particle on Earth, the morphine molecule seemed to possess both heaven and hell. Explain that.
Well, if you think about it, no other molecule can provide such blessed freedom from the horrors of wartime injury and pain mm-hmm. to a soldier. Nothing else is as welcome to a soldier who's been wounded in battle than opiates, some form of opiates. It's a freedom of this horror of pain that I don't want to ever feel in my life, and I can only begin to imagine. At the same time, that same molecule is responsible for utter debasement and slavery, mm-hmm. utter imprisonment. By capturing human beings and enslaving them. It is the most enslaving molecule we've found, I think, in nature today. And it's the same molecule. It's the same molecule does both.
Yeah.
It seemed to me that we were getting into larger questions of can human beings have it all? How do you achieve happiness? I began to read some of the philosophers on this, and Viktor Frankl, I believe he's from the Austrian philosopher, said that happiness, I believe this is him talking, happiness is not something you can pursue. It is a byproduct of pursuing something that stimulates, that fascinates, that you want to achieve. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a pretty brilliant thought. It was not something that you can buy. It's some purchase, some good that you can pursue for its own sake. It's a byproduct of the pursuit of other things that fascinate you or that mean something to you in your life. But this molecule was amazing. I mean, it seems to me if you personify the molecule in some sense, or the poppy as a way to prosper as a flower, was to become completely essential to the dominant mammal on the face of the earth. And in fact, it is spread to all parts of the world, and really wars are what spread it because it's such a fantastic painkiller. And at the same time, as I say, it's this utterly enslaving thing. A kid who will chafe at the smallest chore around the house gets addicted to heroin and will walk 5 miles in a blizzard to get his dope that day, and maybe twice. You know, it's a remarkable thing, and it brought me into questions of how do we achieve happiness. And I think for a long time, it was a reflection too that of how we had thought we could achieve it as a country, as a culture, which was to say, buy it.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting how when heroin is sort of created in the mid 1800s, Dr. Alder Wright creates it. It's based on the German word heroic, by the way. It hadn't occurred to me, yeah. Which is really interesting. And of course, at first he figures this is non-addictive. And this is another big theme, that these opiates right. somehow are non-addictive. They're not a problem. Yeah. But of course, addiction explodes. And eventually it leads us to this time where it became kind of a taboo for doctors to right. prescribe it. And it becomes America's really first prohibition statute, you mention.
The story of opiates is always humankind trying to figure out, God, this is a fantastic painkiller. Let's see if we can find a painkiller that doesn't addict people. Because, as I said, that molecule has got Jekyll and Hyde, right? It's like the beautiful part to it and this nightmarish part to it. Can we get rid of the nightmarish part? You know, can we have it all? Yeah. And over and over, you find throughout history, we have tried to figure this out. There's a whole essentially committee of scientists whose job since the 1920s has been to try to find the non-addictive painkiller that kills pain like morphine.
Right.
Each time they think they've come up with something, it really creates more problems than it solves. And heroin itself is an awful painkiller because it's got that intense addictive potential. It's one of the worst opiate painkillers there is because it has this up and down that's very intense up, very intense down, and leaves people craving more and more, which is not the case with other opiates like methadone, for example. And so
can I mention something you write? I love the way you put this about the morphine molecule, which may be a direct reference in some ways to heroin as well. You say it acts like a spoiled lover. It throws a tantrum as it leaves your body.
Right. You know, everything that happens to you while you're addicted, the opposite happens to you when you're in withdrawals. And it's as if this molecule is screaming and yelling and holding onto the door, not wanting to leave, you know. Yeah. And you get, if you were numb from pain and withdrawals, you get intense, you feel pain intensely in all kinds of things. And you can't even put a wool blanket around you. It scratches so badly. If you're sleeping all the time when you're doped up, you're awake for 2-3 weeks. You know, if you're constipated when you're doped up, you have diarrhea. And it's like this, the body and the morphine molecule just in complete war with each other. And it struck me, and this is from descriptions of from addicts of what it's like to go through that, yes, this was a molecule with almost a mind of its own. It kind of helped understand it if you almost gave it a mind, thought that it had a mind of its own, and it was battling like hell to not be thrown out, to not be cast aside like a spurned lover.
That's M. Quiñones. He's the author of the book Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Tomorrow morning at 8:30, he's going to be delivering the keynote address at the Utah Heroin and Opioid Summit. It's at the Sheraton Hotel in downtown Salt Lake City, and it's free. It's also open to the public. You can get details about it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the epidemic of opioid addiction in this country, which is a problem found pretty much everywhere these days. It crosses over racial and class boundaries. It's particularly acute here in Utah for complicated reasons. The whole story is complicated. And the journalist Sam Quiñones has been trying to track it down for years now. Last year, he published a remarkable book called Dreamland, where he explains how we got to this point. He's speaking at the Utah Heroin and Opioid Summit going on in Salt Lake City this week. He'll be speaking tomorrow. He joined us earlier today. And Quiñones says it used to be that doctors were resistant to prescribe narcotics for pain, but now a pendulum has swung the other way. In the 1990s, attitudes among doctors started to change. And Quiñones is quick to point out those intentions of doctors and medical researchers, they were good and humane. They wanted to stop pain.
People have this idea that the folks who started this pain revolution were greedy, kind of sinister folks. That is not the case.
Yeah.
Put yourself in their shoes as young doctors. You go into medicine to help people, to assuage pain, and you go into these wards where you're seeing people screaming in agony and the doctor saying, I cannot give you the drug that would make your life much better the last 3 months of it you have to live, and would assuage this pain, alleviate your pain. I have the tool. I cannot give it to you because you're going to get addicted.
Yeah.
Imagine if you're a 27, 30-year-old doctor just starting out, and you see that. That would sear you. That would be like a brand in your brain almost. It's just searing experience, and it would color pretty much everything you did from that point on if it was a traumatic enough experience. And I believe that to a certain degree, that's what happened with a whole cadre of doctors who grew into medicine in the 80s,
yeah.
Fresh from the 60s in a sense, you know, kind of a lot of idealism, a lot of ideas of we need to listen to patients and this kind of thing. All of these were the right ideas, I believe. And they developed almost a revolutionary fervor for liberalizing the use of opiates in medicine. And they pushed on that pendulum you're referring to, and they kept pushing, and they were joined by the pharmaceutical companies that were coming out with new versions of opiates, OxyContin in particular, and they pushed and pushed, and that pendulum began to swing, and it didn't stop, or we wouldn't be here today, and it ended up on the other far extreme, which is opiates for everybody. Every wisdom tooth extraction needs 60 Vicodin because, God forbid, anybody feels the slightest little amount of pain.
There's this paper that's written in the mid-1990s that suggests that opiates, in certain circumstances, are not, in fact, addictive.
Right.
And this idea in this paper becomes, as you mentioned in the book, passionately debated. And you write about how pain researchers came here to Utah to look at ways of treating pain patients. Explain why they came here. The Mormon population was
right.
A good segment of population to
it was pet. Yes, one of the places where this pain revolution took place. There were a few, but one of them was Utah, Salt Lake in particular, and that was because the population was stable.
Yeah,
that was a big attraction, because if you have a stable population, you can study people over time, and they're not leaving and coming and going. You lose track of them, etc. And also, there was not a lot of other kinds of drug use. The Mormon Church, you know, with its prohibitions on drugs, but also on tobacco and nicotine and caffeine and so on. What was, however, not frowned on or not prohibited in some way were these opiate painkillers, because it was viewed as something innocuous. In fact, this was an attitude that common all across the country, that if doctors were prescribing them, mm-hmm. then why not? What's the problem? You know. By then, it's also important to understand that there was also like this kind of connections developing. Pain as a discipline was emerging as a thing to study, and there were pain conferences, journals, and so on, and certain doctors emerging throughout across America and these folks in Salt Lake and elsewhere, as I say, were part of this kind of new emerging community saying we do a miserable job of treating pain and we have to really address it very, very aggressively. And then, of course, they latch on to the idea, this is very important in all this, this is crucial in all this, because the people they have to convince are not you and me, they're doctors.
Right.
Doctors have a real reluctance to use these drugs. The key thing they have to get over is that these drugs are very addictive. So they come up with the idea that these drugs are now virtually non-addictive when used to treat pain. And along with that comes, I think, even a more harmful idea, which is that there is no limit on dose, that you can keep raising the dose. If a person's pain is quieted for a while, then it comes back at 100 milligrams a day, well, then maybe 150, maybe 225, maybe 400, and it keeps on going and going and going. There is no limit on dose. And this was really what was behind the pain revolution and the vast, vast supply of opiates that's unleashed on America beginning in the mid-1990s and sloshes around the country from coast to coast, from north to south, every place, because doctors all across the country by the mid to late 1990s are convinced that this is true. Yeah. They're taught this in medical school. They have to learn it at continuing medical education seminars to get their licenses. There's many, many pressures on them to pushing them to prescribe like that. But part of it, a key part of it, was that these are virtually non-addictive when used to treat pain, and that therefore is no limit on the amount of these drugs you can give a patient.
Yeah, which gets us to what you were saying earlier. Doctors now start prescribing pills for wisdom teeth extraction and carpal tunnel syndrome and bad knees and chronic back pain and arthritis and severe headaches. But there hadn't been any real studies about the essential question, that are opiates – two questions, really, you say. Are opiates safe to treat chronic pain? And the second part, are they effective? So what do we, in fact, now – actually know
about
that?
I would say that a lot of people's attitudes are changing on that, particularly pain doctors, pain specialists. I've talked to four in the last, last month or so, just right off the top of my head. And in each case, they have come to drastically reappraise and reassess what they've been doing. In one guy's case, he says, I tell patients what we thought was true was not true. 15, 20 years ago, we thought this was true. There was no limit on dose. That's simply not true. We now know better. And so there's what we are doing is reverting to the old way, which feels like a new way all of a sudden, of treating pain as the very complex thing that it is, which is to say that there could be for one patient many approaches, acupuncture, swimming, cognitive behavioral therapy that could be marital counseling. Part of that might be some role for opiates. It depends. Some doctors, I just talked to one, he said, I don't believe there's any role. Well, what is happening now is we are seeing that, part of the pain revolution and part of the era of the 1990s, early 2000s was we believe that old rules did not apply to us.
Yeah.
And now we're seeing that actually old rules do apply, that you cannot massively prescribe like a fire hose blast of opiate painkillers at an entire population with all kinds of pain, all kinds of backgrounds, all kinds of physical bodies, and so on, and believe that there will not cause massive addiction. And so we are now returning to that from that solitary one size fits all approach. We're returning to a more community approach, an approach of saying all of these things together, we will kind of tinker with and see what helps this person, not everybody who walks in with a bad knee or a wisdom teeth out.
Yeah, Russell Portnoy is one of those doctors who has developed palliative care and says, look, you can use opiates as long as you spend the right amount of time getting to know a patient, understanding their medical and their family history, because you've got to figure out if a person is going to be – it's just good doctoring. You have to spend time. And it seems like in the era of managed care – that opiates were used by doctors to just shorten a patient visit. You say prescription pads were used to shorten patient visits. And
yeah, that's when you—that's when the visit ends, right?
Yeah.
When the doctor pulls out the pad,
right.
Visit over, right? And that was crucially—that's the thing. That's why I think I said in the book, time. Time was of the essence.
Right.
Time was, in pain treatment particularly, very important. Time was the issue. And increasingly, doctors did not have that time. We had patient evaluations. We had these ideas that doctors had to listen to patients. All these things that felt good. They were good, feel good kinds of measures. Probably effective in some cases. But we were losing at that very time the most important thing, which was a doctor and patient in the room together talking about, well, does it hurt here? Or what do we do? You know, it's just kind of testing and treating the patient as an individual. Instead, primary care doctors were spending 13 minutes on average, and I think far less in some cases, you know. And so there's just not enough time to be able to do good medicine when you as a doctor, due to all these issues dealing with reimbursement and maybe the mandates or the limitations of your HMO, have to get people through fast. And yes, the pills solved a crucial issue for doctors, which was, what do I do about these people who drain my time, pain patients primarily? Well, bingo, we have an easy answer. And what's more, the patient loves it because the patient doesn't have to do anything.
Yeah.
These other approaches to pain require the patient do tough things, change how he or she ate, get more exercise, all kinds of things that required accountability on the part of the patient. The pill, you don't have any accountability. You just take the pill, and you don't have to change how you live, much of which could be leading to the pain or the obesity that you have, that kind of thing. And so the pills were like solved a major issue for doctors all across the country, which is why they were kind of eager to adopt them.
We need to spend a little bit of time on the pharmaceutical industries and some of these marketing of these drugs, because it's a fascinating part of the story. One of the things you write about is an interesting ad man by the name of Arthur Sackler. He used to be a psychiatrist, and he develops this campaign for what became Pfizer. It wasn't the mega pharm giant that it is today. It's this campaign for Valium, basically, and he develops these direct selling techniques and this direct advertising. Say something about that, because that sort of leads us also to the way OxyContin was
right. Arthur Sackler was a fascinating guy. He was the first person years before all this. He had a career. He was a fascinating psychiatrist. He was the first one to run a desegregated blood bank in New York City. First anti-smoker. He then becomes probably one of the titans. I have to say one of the two or three titans of pharmaceutical advertising, transforming that with the idea of, our job again is to find out what the problems are that the doctor faces, and offer them products to resolve those problems, solve those problems. And one of the problems is women with depression, and he is the one who turns Valium into the industry's first billion dollar drug. His marketing techniques of direct advertising, direct connection to the doctor. Doctor, we want to know you personally. We're going to send a guy around. He's going to give you a bunch of information. He's going to do it maybe every once month or two, this kind of thing, so that there's a relationship developed. He thought that the pharmaceutical advertising up to then was, in fact, it was quite gray and, you know, just large blocks of text in gray magazines and this kind of thing. He made it far more rambunctious and so on. And he really and that's how he turned Valium into the drug that it became. He died in 87, but he and his brothers had purchased Purdue Pharma, which is the company that makes OxyContin. He had also started a pharmaceutical advertising firm. For the first time, he would not allow that firm to advertise any company that he was associated with. But once he dies, that advertising firm teams up with Purdue Pharma, and they put into place all the strategies and techniques that he had pioneered. in selling OxyContin, yeah. and that is massive pharmaceutical representation in the doctor's offices, lunches,
free
lots
samples.
Of trips to free samples, coupons, free week-long coupons for OxyContin for a few years there. There was a CD called Swing in the Right Direction with OxyContin with Count Basie and Woody Herman songs on there and that kind of thing. And so it was the first time that they had, again, always marketing to doctors, not to you and me, but the doctors were the key thing. They had to be convinced that this was not going to addict people. And that was the idea. That was marketed as virtually non-addictive, no limit on dose, that kind of thing, and that was that's really what paved the way. That kind of money, along with the pain specialists and talking at conferences and whatnot, kind of paved the way for the whole pain revolution.
I want to come back to Dreamland, which is really a kind of a metaphor for a kind of cultural decline, the decline of community, uh-huh. the decline of local economy and American excess, and the idea that, as you say, we're a country of pain, that we can treat pain with more and more pills. Would you say something just about the hope that you eventually find? Ironically, you didn't think you'd find much hope in Portsmouth, Ohio, but in a shoelace factory,
right.
you find what seems to be, if not an answer, at least some kind of solution to all of this. And it seems directed right. at community, right?
Yes. And it also seems directed to me at sloughing off the culture of dependency, which is dependence on Wall Street, the ideas of the Reagan Revolution that we're a country of the financial services, and that all manufacturing needed to be somewhere else. Mm-hmm. That we were a country that like the private sector did everything well and the government did nothing well. All these kinds of ideas infected and affected Portsmouth, Ohio. They kind of bought into that until. I think what began the change and the result was decline, municipal incompetence, widespread opiate addiction, et cetera, until this fascinating thing had nothing to do with heroin. The largest shoelace manufacturer in the world, as I said, was in Portsmouth.
Right.
It had gone through a long period of not decline, but of course competition, so it wasn't the top dog that it had been in the shoelace industry. It then, however, with some, I think, changes at the top, the family that owned it, some new people took over. They made a lot of bad decisions. Anyway, whatever the case, it ended up in bankruptcy. Now, this was exactly the moment when the town of Portsmouth in the past had just thrown up its hands, given up, and said, oh, what can we do? But here, with this one little company, name of Mitchell Lace, mm-hmm. A bunch of guys from the town who had no background in shoelace manufacturing, they were contractors, insurance, lawyers, whatever, put their money together and buy the shoelace manufacturer out of bankruptcy and restart it, hire the two managers, the guy who actually know what they're doing at this company and have a pretty clear idea of where it needs to go. They hire these guys and they save this company. They save those jobs. It's like all of a sudden, you know, the town was like a junkie hitting rock bottom.
Yeah.
And it's at rock bottom when recovery begins. And that's kind of what happened with this shoelace manufacturer. It's almost as if had they let that thing go, there would have been the final dagger in the heart of the town. They could not have survived. Instead, it begins to kind of this self-reliance, again, sloughing off the culture of dependency that the dope represents, you know. And they come to this idea, I think, little by little, it's a gradual thing, that there is a role for them. They can play a role in the town getting better. The state outlaws pill mills in 2011, and they shut down all those pill mills right then. And pretty soon you see this culture of recovery, not unlike the shoelace manufacturer. A recovery from dope.
Yeah.
You get a separation from the addict, and all those nasty pills and those pill mills are gone. And all of a sudden, you get a kind of the narcotic fog begins to lift. This is not to say that Portsmouth, Ohio is a Shangri-La. There's a bunch of bad problems in that town. Heroin is a very big issue. But what is the case is there used to be one story in town, and that was, let's get high all day.
Yeah.
And now it's the competing narrative is, hey, let's break away from that crap. Let's recover. Let's see a brighter day. Let's be positive, energized. And the town, I think, is really being helped by that. This is almost as if they're getting just a whole new infusion of new workers, new people with a whole new attitude because they're breaking away from the dope. Still a lot of problems in Portsmouth, but this competing narrative is one that I thought was exhilaratingly American due to its very the self-reliance that it implied.
Let me ask you this finally. It seems like then you have some sense of optimism about this question. Is there any going back? Because it seems like you've got to change the culture.
Yeah.
How do you reverse the massive forces that brought us to where we are now?
Yeah, I don't know if I have a good answer to that. Honestly, we have so many massive forces arrayed against a community in this country and maybe in the world. I do think though that the answer to a drug that isolates everybody, that forces everybody to be alone, want to be alone, prefer to be alone, the only answer is to come together as community, share experiences. Talk about how to bring together different backgrounds, law enforcement with public health, with the PTA, with the pastors. All of this is part of how you combat a drug that isolates you. And there is, I don't know what each town needs to do. I wouldn't presume to say. I don't live in those towns. But I do think overall that it is time. Heroin is one of the most powerful forces for change in America today because it is forcing us to confront our own isolation. And do something about it and see how devastating and how harmful it has been, not just in drugs, but in a variety of ways, how it leaves us less happy, how it leaves us less unified. And I think that kind of response to heroin would make us a much better country than we were going in.
Sam Quiñones, his book is called Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. The Utah Heroin and Opioid Summit is now underway at the Sheraton Hotel in downtown Salt Lake City. Sam Quiñones is going to be speaking tomorrow morning at 8:30 at the summit. He's delivering the keynote address. And then at 10:30, I'm going to be hosting a panel discussion with some of the people on the front lines of this opioid crisis. That summit is free. It's open to the public. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Emily Anderson. Program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.